Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, How to Architect Microgrids for the Industrial Internet of Things. I'm your moderator, Brandon Lewis, with today's speakers, Brett Murphy of Real Time Innovations and Brett Berger from National Instruments. Before we begin, I'd like to more formally introduce our speakers, starting with Brett Murphy, who is Director of Business Development for the Industrial IoT at Real Time Innovations, the Industrial Internet of Things connectivity platform company. Early on, Brett worked on controls analysis, hardware-in-the-loop test systems, robotics, real-time software development, and systems engineering in the aerospace and embedded software industries. More recently, he has worked on product definition, market strategy, and business development for embedded software tools, network middleware, and scientific computing software. In the distant past, Brett received his BS and MS in aerospace engineering from Stanford University. Brett Berger, Principal Product Marketing Manager of Smart Grid Applications at National Instruments, joined the company in 2003 after graduating with a degree in aerospace engineering from Texas A&M University. He started his career as an applications engineer in the Engineering Leadership Program, where he supported LabVIEW customers in the Platinum Support Queue and eventually became a team lead for new support engineers. In 2005, Mr. Berger transitioned to a role in product marketing, where he assisted the global launch and product management of NI's Compact DAQ technology. Since then, Brett has presented at numerous customer locations and NI technical events, including a keynote at NI Week 2010. Today, as a principal product marketing manager, Brett works on defining the strategy for NI technology that helps engineers measure and control the smart grid. This global role involves constant contact with customers, the field sales team, and R&D to ensure future products continue to help scientists and engineers discover and innovate. Now, before we begin, I'd like to go over some housekeeping items, beginning with the features of the audience viewing console. The Enlarge Slides button will maximize the presentation slides to fill your entire screen. And second, the Download Slides button will allow you to download and print the slides if you prefer to follow along with a hard copy. Next, the Forward to a Friend button enables you to send an email that includes a registration link to this eCast so that friends and colleagues can attend as well. The Ask a Question text box allows you to participate in the event by simply typing your question into the box and hitting the Submit Question button below. You can submit questions at any time during the course of the presentation, and we encourage you to do so early and often while reviewing the material. We'll address as many of these questions as possible during the closing Q&A, and if you have questions about the eCast operation itself, feel free to submit those as well, and we'll have one of our technicians assist you. A final note before we begin the presentation is a reminder that all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded without prior permission. So at this point, I'd like to hand it off to Brett Berger of National Instruments. Take it away, Brett.
Thank you very much, Brandon. And thanks to all of the viewers as we go through how to architect microgrids for the Industrial Internet of Things. A quick outline as we get started. We're going to first cover, you know, what is a smart grid and talk a little bit about microgrids at a high level. We'll then move through what we see as the architectural considerations for working on a microgrid, and then get into some more specific details about the Industrial Internet Consortium testbed, of which we were a part. And then finally, we're going to really talk about exactly the hardware, the software, and some of the data protocols that we're using. So when talking about a smart grid, you know, we really see laying out an infrastructure of these intelligent, interconnected nodes that is going to enable many optimizations and efficiencies for this enormously large machine that we call our utility grid. You may have heard of terms like Internet of Things, big data, asset utilization. All of these will be possible, we see, as long as we can make the underlying intelligent infrastructure open. So that's a lot of what we focus on. Now, it's not just about, you know, technology and adding things for the sake of adding things. There's a lot of challenges that are happening on the grid now that are pulling this need for technology. So, you know, I have here on the slide an image of the traditional grid where you've got your large-scale power generation on one end, and then it kind of radiates out and moves down through the transmission system and then down to the distribution where it ultimately goes into our homes, our office buildings, our college campuses, et cetera. But there's been, you know, a lot of change recently that is providing some challenges to the utility operators. So instead of having central large-scale power generation, now you can have distributed generation. So here we have large-scale wind turbines plugged into transmission-level substations. They can also appear at the distribution level. They can appear on our homes. So we have distribution in places that, you know, decades ago were not necessarily envisioned by the grid engineers as we were laying out our grid. And of course, it's not just, you know, generation technologies that are changing. It's also what we're plugging into the grid. So electric vehicles, ever-increasing demand, population density, all of these things are creating challenges for our grid operators. Now, when we talk about microgrids, you know, I just wanted to kind of pull a definition, so I have this off of Wikipedia. And it's really talking about arbitrary boundary where you create a smaller subset of a fully functioning grid. So you typically are going to have generation and demand within the confines of your microgrid. Typically, the generation is going to be renewables, so it'll be clustered around solar or wind. But that doesn't mean it has to be. You know, there's certainly on-site spinning reserves or generation that could be a part of it. I've seen microgrids both with and without storage, so talking about battery backup and on-site storage. But generally, a microgrid is a lot, you know, like it sounds. It is a smaller version of the larger grid. Now, when we want to lay out, you know, an architecture, before we even start, you want to have some goals, right, some careabouts. And, you know, you start talking about technology, interoperability, all of these buzzwords right now. And three things come to mind as paramount, right? So security, very hot topic. If we're talking about critical infrastructure and control systems on critical infrastructure, security is obviously of utmost importance. Interoperability, it's not going to be one vendor solving the problems of the grid. It's going to be multiple vendors, multiple technologies, new technologies in the future. So it's really important to establish an open scheme such that all of these systems can plug in and interoperate. And then finally, scalability, both in size but also in scope. The challenges that a grid has today might be different than the challenges that it has 5 years from now, 10 years from now. And, you know, with something like grid technology, that's not something that you can replace every couple of years. So you want to plan for an architecture that's going to grow with the needs and the challenges of the system. And so with that, I want to turn it over to Mr. Brett Murphy so he can talk a little bit about the Internet of Things.
Thanks, Brett. So I think we've all heard about the IoT, the Internet of Things. And when we look at the Internet of Things, we see two major breakdowns or two different areas of the Internet of Things. One is consumer. You know, those are the Nest thermostats, Nest, or the Fitbit wearables, and those sorts of things. On the other hand, we see applications like smart highways, energy systems, medical, and those are the types of systems that we call the industrial Internet of Things, and it's the type of system that we're going to be concentrating on when we talk about the power grid and the smart grid. And just note that, you know, you look at the hype out there, I'd say about 8% of it's coming from the consumer side and the applications there. They are quite fun. But actually, based on industry analysts and looking at it, about 80% of the value of the IoT is going to come from the industrial side, instrumenting and putting intelligence at the edge in all of these industrial systems and then tying them back to big data and analytics. So to help drive the coalescence and the streamline moving forward the industrial internet, about a year ago or a little over a year ago, the Industrial Internet Consortium was formed by GE, Intel, Cisco, AT&T, and IBM. It's now up over 180 members, and its purpose is to establish interoperability and security standards for the industrial internet. And there are three major areas, the primary areas, that the IIC is working in. One, it's obviously an ecosystem of vendors and users and technology companies. It's also working on setting up technology and security, architectures in particular. And then it's also got some major activity around test beds. And obviously the ecosystem helps to create the market and get a single voice talking about what the industrial internet should look like. The technology and security should and is providing an IIoT-wide, so across multiple industries like transportation, healthcare, power and energy, and so forth, a single cross-industry architecture providing that interoperability and security. And then the test beds are there as proofs of concept to bring partners together, create end-to-end solutions, and demonstrate them in various settings. And it was with this in mind that RTI, National Instruments, and Cisco got together and created this communication and control testbed for microgrid application. We are putting this together in concert with partners from the power industry, including CPS Energy, which is the largest municipal utility down in San Antonio, Texas, Southern California Edison, and then also we're working collaboratively with Duke Energy, a large utility from the East Coast, the North Carolina area, and the Smart Grid Interoperability Panel, an industry consortium in the power industry focused on the smart grid. And the purpose is to put together a microgrid and specifically an edge communication and control, which puts intelligence and data connectivity down at the edge, which is obviously needed for microgrid. And the challenges we're looking to address with this smart communication and control architecture are the three architectural considerations that Brett Berger just talked about earlier. One, obviously, cybersecurity is a founding architectural principle in this communication control framework. And we're going to be establishing data interoperability with an open standard so that multiple vendors can come in and connect and put their equipment in there and interoperate. And the framework is scalable, obviously, for peer-to-peer communication at the edge, back to controllers in the middle, and possibly all the way up to cloud or data center analytics. And this could be a utility control center or could be out at the cloud. In addition to these three areas, we're also putting together a system that addresses the ability to incrementally build, upgrade, expand, and create compatibility with legacy installations and protocols, because these systems are going to be going into neighborhoods or into buildings where there's legacy equipment already in place. These are brownfield applications, so we need to be able to interface and upgrade going forward. And obviously, the main purpose is to create an intelligent system control at the edge. So this testbed project is phased. We're not going to put this immediately in the field with, you know, real power generation and houses that depend on it. So phase one, we've already, I would say, about halfway through. And Brett Berger at National Instruments has set up a lab there with demonstration equipment and so forth, pulled together, so kind of proving the concept of the integration, proving the concept of the communication control framework. The next step will be to put it into Southern California Edison's simulated microgrid lab down in Southern California, obviously. And there we'll be able to look at scalability, performance, and security in a safe environment. And then finally, once that's all completed, we're looking to deploy at a real-world microgrid at CPS Energy down in San Antonio. And so as we go through this project, there are many use cases, many applications within microgrids that we could be looking at. The ones we're going to be focusing on, at least for now, are grid optimization. So as the microgrid is running in its day-to-day setup, it needs to optimize and present to the grid itself a fairly smooth, relatively controllable section of the grid for the utility to manage. This is in situations where you have cloudy days and the solar is coming in and out. The microgrid in this mode kind of smooths all of those rough edges to make it easier for the utility to handle some of these distributed demand power generation. Another mode is storm resiliency. So, for example, let's say we're on the coast of Texas, there's a hurricane coming, we can switch to this mode, and the goal here is to get the batteries, assuming we have them, powered up, and to shed non-critical loads, pull from the grid as much as possible to get ready for the possibility of the grid going down and the microgrid having to go into island mode and to function as an independent grid, using batteries, shedding loads as it needs to, just and using whatever is available to keep power for the critical load needs in the microgrid. And then when the grid comes back and the sun comes out after the hurricane, the power generation in the microgrid has to be resynchronized, so it's in phase with the general grid, and then it can be reconnected to the grid. So these are the use cases that we're concentrating on. And as we're putting this microgrid together, obviously it's a connection of intelligent things at the edge. And as we look at these things and think about what we need to put into place to make this all work well, there are three major elements or capabilities that these intelligent things at the edge need. One is connectivity, others processing, and obviously the things need to be able to connect to and from the intelligence at the edge to the actual hardware, to the actual electronics, to the actual devices. And so we're going to take a quick look at these different elements, starting with connectivity. So the components that we're going to need for these things to participate in the industrial internet and in a microgrid is reliable messaging. And using, obviously, since it's internet, we need to have reliable messaging on top of TCP and hopefully UDP so we can take advantage of performance of multicast. Also, we're going to have quality of service around data delivery, how quickly it gets through, and fault tolerance. So if you have important data, you might need a backup. And also, how long is that data going to last in the system? There's a variety of QoS that are needed. Obviously, we need communication security. We need to authorize and authenticate participants on the network and encrypt and support non-repudiation, et cetera. And then each node is going to have to kind of keep track of what it's getting from the other parts of the network, from the other things on the network. So there needs to be some sort of local caching of data that's important to the thing on the network. And of course, it needs to be able to discover the other things on the network, what's out there and what they care about, what data do they need, what data do they have. So just step back quickly, the Industrial Internet Consortium put out on June 17th the first high-level version of the Industrial Internet Reference Architecture, the IIRA. And in that reference architecture, there's a section on connectivity. If we zero in on that a bit, what the Industrial Internet Consortium is putting forward as a reference architecture is the concept of having a core connectivity standard, essentially a bus, a connectivity bus, that connects everything together and represents a single superhighway for data and information. Now, you can have endpoints that speak that connectivity standard natively, and they'll just connect right up to the bus. But often you're going to have legacy devices or devices that are going in that do not speak that core connectivity standard. And then they use this concept of a gateway that translates between the core and the edge devices that are not speaking the core language. So there could be protocols like Modbus or DMP3, and you can have these connected up to the system through these gateways. And for this microgrid testbed, we're going to be using DDS. And DDS is a data-centric messaging bus, an open standard for data-centric connectivity managed by the Object Management Group, the OMG, which is the world's largest system software standards organization. You may remember or know of UML. The OMG manages and puts out that standard. The OMG is also the administration organization behind the IIC, so it helps run that consortium for the members. And DDS is an open standard. There are open source versions, and over 12 implementations or commercial versions of that, including from RTI. And I've used this term data-centric just to explain it a little bit. I'm going to use an analogy. You may remember the bad old days of integrating applications together. Some still do it, where you want to share data with another application. What you can do is just write it out to some file. It could be whatever format you want. Then you write the second application. It knows the name of the file. It reads it in. It knows the format of the data, and that's how you can share data back and forth. That doesn't scale very well because all of that information, all of that knowledge has to be, coded into each application. So Oracle came along, created this concept of the SQL database, and grew very large and created a heck of a lot of value with this concept of a database. And this is data-centric, meaning that if I have an application, I just write data out to this database in a data table or a row of that data table. If I'm an application and I need some data, I just open the database and I read it in. I don't care exactly where it came from or how many different applications have written to that table. The truth and the core nugget of integration is the data itself. So the database is data-centric application integration for data at rest. With this concept, can be also applied to networking and messaging middleware. So analogous to the unstructured files are the middleware and the protocols like MQTT or Modbus or DMP3. Basically there you have a lower level messaging bus and the data types and formats, that's kind of left and where the data is and who you have to connect to get the data. That's left to the application developer or the system developer. All that logic has to go into the application code. With something like DDS, with a data-centric data bus, you're working at a higher level of abstraction. And what you have are named pieces of data. You have publishers of that data, and you have subscribers to that data. You write the data that you have, and you receive as a subscriber the data that you want from the data bus. So much the way that the database made application integration much more interoperable, scalable, the same happens over the network with a data-centric middleware like DDS. So with DDS in this system, they're running on these things, looking back at the components. We have a real-time publish-subscribe protocol, which is part of the DDS standard called RTPS. There's over 21 QoS settings within DDS that govern how the data flow connections behave between the different publishers and the subscribers. There's a DDS secure specification, and this is kind of neat because it allows security per data topic. So much like in a database, where you secure a table of data and you say this application is allowed to write it, and this application is allowed to read it, you have the same model in DDS. DDS, the middleware itself, maintains a local cache of all the data that the local node or the local thing cares about, and not an entire replication of all the data in the system. And the application doesn't have to do that itself. And then there's also automatic discovery within DDS. So it finds all of the nodes on the DDS data bus and what they are publishing and what they are subscribing to. So that's a quick overview of the, well, not so quick perhaps, connectivity aspect of these intelligent things. I'm going to turn it back over to Brett Berger to talk about the next.
Thanks, Brett. So continuing on with the layers of what's in these things, I want to talk about the processing capability. Now, with the concept of open and interoperability in mind, I've just listed out, you know, kind of what I see as the potential players when we talk about these intelligent nodes. So everything from the standard workhorse, the CPU, to kind of specific functionality processing elements like FPGAs, GPUs, DSPs, or extremely specific like the ASIC. All of these will have a place on intelligent devices, and when we talk about the architectures and the technologies that we're looking at, they're all taken into account as potential additions. Now, I'll get in a couple of slides here, I'll talk about specifically which ones we're using on our hardware, but for now, just kind of understand from a high level, all these intelligent devices are going to have some kind of processing capability, and it may or may not be a combination of everything you see there. Similarly, they're all going to need some kind of sense and respond. You know, if you have a sensor out there, it's going to need to connect to the DDS data bus somehow. So whether that's through a sensor in a gateway or an intelligent sensor, you're still going to have the need for inputs to sensors. And then on the other side, if you're controlling something, whether that is a switch, tap change controller, a cap bank controller, there's going to need to be some kind of physical output to connect to the actual thing that's being controlled. So with all of those levels, the connectivity, the processing, and the input-output, I'm going to flip over and show you more details about what we are doing today with our testbed with the IIC and microgrid. So the embedded controllers that we are using are this programmable sensor and gateway controller from National Instruments. This is known as Compact Rio. And there's some built-in physical ports, so we have Ethernet, serial, 485, and then it has modular adapters for various sensors, voltage, current, your standard PTs and CTs, high voltage digital, industrial level control outputs. All of this corresponds to the signal input and output layer. One layer up, when we talk about the processors, this particular one uses a dual core ARM processor running a Linux, the deterministic version of Linux, and then it also has a FPGA coprocessor, which in itself, because of the technology that Xilinx uses, this particular FPGA has built-in DSP slices. So these controllers lend themselves to be pretty flexible for all the different control and measurement functions and applications that we've kind of laid out, but they certainly don't exclude any of the other devices or processing elements that we've talked about. So I have multiple of these embedded controllers on the network, and the network being the DDS data bus. And so what that lets us do is, if you can imagine, say, five of these intelligent controllers, some of them I have labeled as logic controllers, some of them are measurement, and some of them are control. And by distributing them on the data bus, you end up with architectures that have a control device whose sole function is to output an actuation signal, again, to a tap change controller, tap bank controller, an intelligent inverter, or what have you. But the control signal receives its intelligence from one of the logic devices that could be somewhere else on the network. And this logic device, some of the inputs for the logic are actually coming from two completely different controllers. And so you end up with this open distributed scheme of intelligent instruments where as long as they are connected to the data bus, anything, any measurement or data point that one of them perceives can be used by all of them. And so it creates this very scalable, open architecture where interoperability is driven a lot by that central data bus and the ability to get to it. So bridging back to what Brett Murphy was talking about with the reference architecture and gateways from brownfield to greenfield. And I have an example of that coming up. So if we switch from kind of the abstract, let's call them things view, to a explicit image of what our test bed looks like right now. From a data view, again, we've got that data bus, and you can see the three images on the top, those three devices, are all built on that Compact Rio embedded dual-core ARM technology. The one on the left is in a enclosure designed for substation mounts. So from left to right, that is an input, so that's one of the measurement things. The one in the center is doing logic. So the logic driving our microgrid demo lives on just that one controller, but it's actually getting inputs from the device on the left, as well as the power quality measurement box on the bottom. So the blue device is a Schweitzer power quality analyzer, and it communicates over DNP3. It actually has a number of communication protocols, but one of them is not DDS. So to get to DDS to bridge that, we connect that to the embedded controller and then push that on into the logic and then up ultimately to the data bus. So the measurements from that device are available to all of the devices. And then finally, the last device on the far right labeled controller or control, that is controlling some relays that allow us to switch some loads on and off purely for demonstration purposes. So measurement, logic, and control signals are split up amongst multiple intelligent devices. And we do that to demonstrate the interoperability through the data bus. Now, if we look at physically, if you were to come to the lab or if you were able to see the demo in person, we have some simple light bulbs and AC-driven fans to simulate loads, typical house loads or office building loads, connected to a single grid. We're using a single-phase grid for our demo. And we also have the ability to have a solar panel and a battery bank that we can connect to the grid through an inverter. And then if we want to simulate islanding effects, we can simply unplug the grid from the main, which in this instance is just a standard wall outlet. But this is the physical layout, but remember we have these intelligent instruments connected at various points on our grid. So you measure in one point, put it on the data bus, and that is available to every instrument, and it creates this nice, open, interoperable architecture that would let any number of new smart grid, what I would call smart grid technologies, plug in. And that's really what we're looking to do is say, how can we create all of these systems that vendors and companies and researchers are working on and lay out an architecture that lets them plug in as components of a larger system. So if you would like a chance to see this, upcoming chances for the IIC microgrid testbed demo, we have one coming up at National Instruments annual user conference. It will be on the expo floor, so August 3rd through August 6th here in Austin, Texas. Free admission to the expo floor. And then also in September, we will be at the IoT Solutions World Congress in Barcelona, Spain, and we will also be on the exhibit floor there. So I would encourage anybody that's interested and able to make the trip to, you know, stop by and be able to take a look at our microgrid and our open architecture. And so with that, I'd like to turn it back over to Brandon.
Great. Thanks a lot, Brett. Actually, thanks to both Bretts for walking us through the IIoT microgrid architectures there. Reminder to the audience, we have about 25 minutes full of unfettered access to the experts here on microgrid architectures, so keep those questions coming, and we'll get through as many of them as we possibly can. There's a question here for Brett Berger. Really quickly, in the Compact Rio family, do you have any product offerings that are x86-based as opposed to ARM-based?
Yes. So in the Compact Rio, there's multiple of those processing options that are available. We do have some that are x86 and some that are ARM. And why you would use one over another, you know, just looking at the processing technology, it could vary based on your application. But the important thing is that, you know, looking at the microgrid as a whole, you know, with multiple vendors and multiple instruments, you could have a variety of different processing elements involved. And then specifically with the ones that we chose, we're using ARM, but there are certainly ones that we could have picked that use x86. So.
Okay, great. Now here's a question for you, Brett Murphy. Really using words like totally secure or completely secure, it's hard to do, but in the DDS context, what makes it really secure beyond encryption and authentication? How is it securing more effectively than some other types of protocols?
Sure. So DDS has DDS Secure, I should say, has a series of plugins that handle the authentication, authorization, encryption, as well as data logging and data tagging that are kind of the engines of the security stack in DDS. What's useful about DDS security is you can use it very flexibly in real-time systems. So, for example, if you have weather data and you don't really care if somebody can snoop in and take a look at your weather data, you don't have to encrypt that piece of data. Now, for some reason, that data may be coming from the same intelligent node as some kind of critical to the system piece of data, and you want to encrypt that one. So you don't have to encrypt absolutely everything going on to the network. You can pick and choose. So that can help with performance. One thing that you can also do is you could encrypt everything that's going on to the network. You could also have a separate set of security pieces that go beyond DDS that secure each node, you know, like a secure version of Linux and so on and so forth, and, you know, hardware tamper-proof enclosures on the endpoints. That's beyond the DDS communication security. But if somebody manages to break in and compromise one of the applications on that secure node, and they now have access to the secure network as well, and so they are now a malicious insider in essence. So with DDS, you could, depending on which application they break into, you can limit what access that application has to the remote nodes by saying this application can only write this piece of data, can only read this piece of data. And so the reach of a compromised application is much limited. So that's how you can add it to current lower level network security layers.
Okay, great. So that's also kind of an extension of how you would just go about managing encryption in a DDS-based system as well, right?
Yes. Yeah, so DDS security, right now there are default plugins, but typically many system integrators are going to be using their own, you know, public key, PKI infrastructure and so forth, and that's kind of separate typically from the DDS Secure implementation.
Okay, great. Kind of a follow-up to that. You mentioned DDS Secure. So with these different types of profiles, I guess, if you will, is there one that's better suited to particular applications than another? So DDS Secure for one sort of use case or scenario, and then another DDS flavor or variant for others?
So typically you're going to have, for each node on the network, you're going to have some sort of permissions file which tells it what it's allowed to do, what it's not allowed to do, and that will vary across the network. And that sort of provisioning needs to be provided as well.
Okay, great. Back to you, Brett Berger. You mentioned in your definition that basically a microgrid is kind of an arbitrary definition of, you know, how much load, an area, number of nodes, et cetera, in terms of scale. But from your experience, what would you say is a typical microgrid deployment? What would you classify that as?
It's tough to pin down a typical. I've seen it scale from, you know, large office complexes or large buildings to, you know, a substation, you know, depending on how many feeders are connected to that substation. I think, you know, again, you mentioned, and we mentioned it was arbitrary. I think at the smaller end of that scale and at the larger end of the scale, you begin to lose some of the benefits of a microgrid. You either, at one end, it becomes too burdensome for the benefit you get, and at the other end, you line up with the same native problems of the grid at large. So theoretically, though, it could be, you know, I've had theoretical conversations that the microgrid could be a house. If you have solar panels on the roof and, say, one of the new Tesla power packs hanging on your wall in the garage, and a plug-in electric vehicle, you could, in a sense, set up your own microgrid just in your house. But typically, from a utility perspective, you know, they're going to be aligned around larger solar fields, larger installations of renewable generation.
Excellent. All right. Just a reminder to the audience, have a lot of time left, so keep those questions coming, and we'll get through as many of them as we can. Here's one for you, Brett Murphy, again. You were talking about databases a little bit during your portion of the presentation. When using DDS, are the databases you're referring to relational? Are they object-oriented? Are they something else? Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. I should explain. There actually is no database in DDS. I was using the database as an analogy for data at rest. For data in motion, we're talking about a data bus. And the analogy I was using was for relational databases. But in the data bus, it's a strict peer-to-peer. There is no central broker. There is no central database. It's just each node knows what data it has and what data it wants. And then the DDS middleware in a kind of a background protocol is keeping track of that configuration and making sure that updates get shared to the right nodes. So there is no actual database in the system. There can be on a particular node to kind of store data and keep it for a long period of time. But generally, it's just going to be intelligent nodes talking to each other.
Great. And here's another question for you, Brett Murphy, and then Brett Berger, feel free to follow up. Are there ways to optimize programs or algorithms in microgrid controllers in these types of architectures? And does RTI support any model-based designs using MATLAB and vice versa, since you guys have been working together?
There's a couple of questions there. So, yes, you can. RTI does have an integration with Simulink for model-based design. So if you're generating code, MathWorks has an integration with DDS that will generate the inputs and outputs, the reads and the writes to DDS. I'll put my perspective out there and then probably turn it over to Brett Berger, but how do you put programs or optimization algorithms into the microgrid? you have a variety of options. So with the data bus, you can connect, you know, a compute node anywhere on the data bus and start receiving data to subscribe to it and then publish commands or optimization set points back to the data bus from wherever. Rep Broger, maybe you have more to add?
Yeah, you know, a question like this, it's kind of a good example of the blend where you will have kind of the specific tool chains. So how do you adapt or how do you put algorithms on an embedded controller? That might vary from vendor to vendor and tool chain to tool chain. But the important thing is that all of these different options can eventually plug into these open interoperable architectures like we're working on with the microgrid testbed. So I know certainly, you know, the MathWorks has a tool chain, National Instruments has a tool chain. You can do the roll your own where you build up from, actually ordering components from the silicon vendors and building your own operating system and doing an in-house kind of design like a lot of the large vendors to the utility market do, you know, every day in-house. So I think, I mean, the short answer is there's lots of options. And that's kind of the engineering process. And, you know, companies like RTI and National Instruments and the MathWorks are all, you know, they're all trying to help engineers with this type of design problem.
Okay, excellent. Here's kind of a wide open question, and we covered a couple of them here. It's a question about standards or guidelines for building microgrids. Obviously, DDS is one of them. Obviously, reference architectures from Industrial Internet Consortium is another. But I'll start with you, Brett Berger. Do you have any sort of insight or examples or places that people could look for kind of sort of guidelines or frameworks for building out microgrid solutions that we haven't talked about today?
I think what some of the work that we're doing, I would hope that in the very near future, people are looking to the IIC and the work that we're doing. RTI, National Instruments, and Cisco are standing up this testbed for microgrid research. But there's lots of academic research universities out there that are working on microgrids. It's a popular topic not only for utility applications, but there's also military applications is a strong use for microgrids when you think about forward operating bases and how you don't have a kind of a dominant power source. You end up with a amalgam of a variety of different resources out there. When it comes to, you know, standards, there's certainly standards for, you know, islanding detection. There's standards for phaser measurement. There's a lot of power standards that deal with specific applications that would roll into a microgrid. But, you know, when it comes to putting it all together, I think that's why you see a bunch of these, you know, test beds and working groups like the IIC testbed and like the SGIP and like what Duke Energy is doing with the Coalition of the Willing. So I would hope that in the very near future there will be some very good architectures that people can follow and innovate on.
Excellent. And Brett Murphy, I'll just give this one to you. What's the best way to go about getting involved in the IIC, getting involved in test beds and working groups? Do you have any instructional value there?
Sure. There's going to be two ways. The best way is to join the IIC.
Right.
And as a member of the IIC, you'll get access to all of the working groups and all of the test beds, even the ones that have not been announced or are in proposal stage. For those who are interested in specific test beds, there are publicly announced test beds from the IIC, and I believe the lead companies on those are listed. Not sure about the contact information, but you can get the contact information for each test bed from the IIC and then reach out to those leads. With IIC test beds, non-IIC organizations, non-members are allowed to participate in IIC test beds so long as the lead companies see value and invite them to come in.
Great. All right. Another reminder to the audience, keep those questions coming. We've still got about 10 minutes left, so we'll get through as many of them as we possibly can. Here's a question for you, Brett Berger. Can you talk a little bit to demand management software and the current methods, current preferred methods of energy storage?
Yeah, absolutely. So my view of demand management software is that it is one of the systems that needs to be plugged into the microgrids technology that we're working on. In our test bed, we have not directly worked with any demand management software in particular. But again, that is, you know, that's the kind of thing where if it is not interoperate, then this solution is not going to be very practical and adopted by the industry at large. So the hope, the goal would be to have this technology such that any demand management software from any of the vendors would cleanly and efficiently plug in. As for storage, it's kind of the same answer, but just shifting over to more of a hardware-based solution. So whether we're talking about, you know, pumped hydro or, you know, traditional, any of the battery technologies out there, you know, you talk about flywheel technology. There's a lot of different technologies that people are looking at right now for storage. And from the microgrid lens, it's pretty agnostic with what we're trying to do. Of course, with the different storages, you might have different, and you would have different, control technologies, control and measurement requirements. And again, you go back to the intelligent things map that we laid out with the three layers, communication, processing, and sensing. Those might vary a little bit, so like which processing element you use, which type of algorithms you're using to monitor a particular type of energy storage. Those would change. But plugging it into the microgrid, plugging it into the architecture, that would still be the ultimate goal.
Great. All right. Here's a pretty general one. I'll give it to actually, let's go back and follow up on this one. Can you talk a little bit more, Brett Murphy, to databases versus data buses and how databases would work within the DDS framework?
Yeah. So with the data bus concept, basically you have applications that are connecting via the DDS API to a local data bus. It's a conceptual or logical entity. And so they publish data onto the data bus when they have it, and the middleware takes care of figuring out who wants to receive that. And it passes it only to those that care about it or who are subscribed to it. And so they end up with updates per the QoS. So it's just read and write to the data bus. Now, you can have databases on, say, a server that's attached to the data bus. And you can, you know, just write a database application that reads data off the data bus and writes it into the database for more permanent storage. We actually have a product that will synchronize the data bus and publishers and subscribers on the data bus with a ODBC-based database, whatever that might be, so you can get, you know, whenever somebody writes to the table on the other side of the database, that update will get published onto the data bus. So there is a conversion between the PubSub database and the ODBC database. I'm getting them mixed up. The PubSub data bus with the ODBC database. Thanks.
Databases, data buses, and two Bretts. So, Brett Berger, what can you expect in terms of control rates since sensors are disconnected from logic controllers in a microgrid architecture? So can you speak to that?
That's a good question. And that's one of the things that we plan on benchmarking and testing in this test bed. Right now, in a lab setting, everything's controlled and we're seeing, pretty low latency. Very fast response times. But one thing to point out is that when we talk about command control, or what I'll call command control on a grid, the response times, can be, with today's technology, with typical back to the cloud or back to the to the central to the operator, that backhaul can take minutes in some cases. So having more intelligence and processing capability on the edge, even with it being distributed, the expectation is the control rates will be not only good, but provide a great impact to the efficiency that the system can operate at.
Great. All right, back to you, Brett Murphy. This is kind of a general question, and it really just has to do with kind of explaining a little bit more about DDoS in general, but how do you track and interpret things, quote-unquote, in terms of security and big data using DDoS as the backbone protocol for these deployments?
Well, that can be a very general question indeed. In a DDoS system, all the applications, these are the software applications on the things, kind of register with the middleware and have a global ID, and that becomes their identity on the data bus. If you're talking about the things in general, that's actually an excellent point. It starts to get into the concept of identity of the things and the endpoints, and that's kind of important when you talk about security and where the data is coming from.
Right.
That's the concept of identity is part of the IIRA, the Industrial Internet Reference Architecture. There are also vendors in the IIC that have and are bringing out device management as well as security management, some of them together. Solutions that kind of combine with that identity. So that's kind of a general answer to fairly good, but a general question.
Broad question. All right. Here's a question for both of you, Brett, Brett Murphy, since you're on the mic now. We'll just continue with you, and then Brett Berger, if you want to jump in at the end. Since we've discussed IIC test beds, are there commercially deployable microgrid solutions available right now, or are those still a little bit off in the future?
Yes, they are definitely available. There are microgrids out there running right now, and some are actual, not just test beds, but real deployed. And, for example, there are islands where they are, in essence, their own little grid with their own power generators and so forth, and they use microgrid technology. Brett Berger might have some more to add.
So I guess to build on top of that, so not only are microgrids being used today, like Brett Murphy said, but they're also being explored as future financial revenue models, right, where you talk about microgrids as a service, being able to host a microgrid to a utility for operational efficiency, and selling that as part of operating expenses. So there is a lot of very interesting focus on microgrids right now. I guess the one other thing I'll point out is Brett Murray mentioned like islands and other and installations like that. There's also the military forward offering base where you have several companies, several defense contractors, at least in the U.S., that have running deployed microgrids, kind of working out in the middle of wherever the military is deployed.
Great answer. Okay, time for probably one last question here, and this is for Brett Murphy. What's the expected latency time scale with DDoS on a microgrid for seconds versus milliseconds versus microseconds?
It can do all of the above. And it's really dependent on the network underneath it. So, we have deployments where it's they're using like gigabit Ethernet in between the nodes, and you can do kilohertz loop rates over that fairly with very good latency and very good jitter characteristics. So, but microgrid's typically going to be a little bit longer. The network's going to be a little bit lighter. But it will definitely handle the millisecond, 1 millisecond on up. very easily.
All right. Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of our time today. And for those of you who had questions we didn't get to or that were pretty specific, we'll be sure to have appropriate representatives from each of our sponsors today follow up with you. I want to thank our speakers, Brett Berger and Brett Murphy of National Instruments and RTI, respectively. And we at Open Systems Media, National Instruments, and Real-Time Innovations would also like to thank you, the audience, for attending and contributing some great questions. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within the next 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will be made available there as well. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media's eCast available for download there as MP3s. Thanks for attending, and have a great day.